don't take advantage of that. Please don't take advantage of that by leaving and forcing us. all right. We had a pretty fruitful discussion or session yesterday, and we thought we would continue where we left off by actually debating many of the issues that had arisen. Before we go there, though, you all know that we had received a request from Professor Cottrell, former Minister of Justice in Canada, who's in South Africa and had requested to meet with the committee. As a consequence of the confusion over tomorrow's program, I had thought that we could meet with Professor Cottrell during the afternoon, because initially it was thought the plenary had been cancelled. It now seems that the plenary is still going to take place. But in the light thereof, well, either way, fine, but, you know, we need clarity on these things, otherwise we create confusion in the minds of a whole lot of other people. I then went ahead and asked to meet Professor Cottrell tomorrow morning between 9 and 10. I'm therefore appealing to all members of the committee to try and make yourself available. I don't know what Professor Cottrell is going to speak to us about. He is the former Minister of Justice in Canada. But I'm assured that he's an old friend of South Africa's. I've also asked Christine Silkstone to be present, and Mr. Romano. And Julian? Yes, Julian as well. Okay, I don't think it's a meeting where the media can be present. The venue is the little lounge that's behind the new restaurant. They've created a little lounge there where we can sit in a nice, relaxed atmosphere. I've ordered refreshments for us, and we'll have to see what happens. All right? Okay. Back to the business of the day, honorable members. You were all here, so I don't have to round up yesterday's discussions, but for Mr. Jeffrey's sake, we received the presentation from the South African Police Service, and a very extensive one from General Haldenes and Colonel Van Rooyen, who are still here with us. There were several concerns raised by honorable members, and under the circumstances we felt that we should carry on where we left off yesterday. Essentially, some of those concerns are the following. It revolves around the question of what General Haldenes referred to as the use of force in order to incapacitate a fleeing suspect. Now, in his input, General Haldenes explained that this is sometimes something that is forced upon the police. So that is a matter which, honorable members, I think we should interrogate and examine carefully. The other issue, of course, is something, even if it is not part of our remit, but which we should look at, is the training received by the police. Without in any way wanting to infringe on our sub judice rule, we know that recently a junior policeman was given an R5 rifle, and subsequently a child was shot dead by the same Geneva police. So clearly, certainly from my point of view, training received by the police in the use of deadly force is a cause for concern. There are other issues, and these arose during the question and comment stage of our discussion yesterday. The physical fitness of police members. All too often, it seems, well, those who subscribe to the adage that it's a question of stomachs out, bums out, as opposed to stomachs in, chests out. So you know, it's then a lot easier for that policeman or woman to whip out the firearm and try to incapacitate a fleeing suspect instead of chasing after him or her. One of the points raised by a civil society organization, Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, makes the point very strongly that it would be important for the police to commit to the protection of human life as a core value. And General Haldanes made the point that if they did that, then that effectively would mean they wouldn't be able to use deadly force. I'm not sure that I agree with him, but I leave that for you to consider. Of course, General Haldanes makes the point that a distinction needs to be drawn between the use of force in order to effect or bring about an arrest and the use of force in order to defend oneself. In this case, a policeman or policewoman having to defend himself or herself from deadly force being used against him or her and the general public. The two case references that we have at the moment are the Govender judgment, which was made in one of our high courts, I think, Supreme Court of Appeal, sorry, and of course the Walters judgment, which was made in our Constitution. So, honourable members, I've said enough now, so I'm going to hand it over to you. You're quite welcome to pose further questions to both General Haldanes and Colonel Van Hoyle. I think that'll be in order, General Haldanes. But essentially now, you know, we're at the stage where it's a very simple bill on the surface. I believe it's a very, very deep, complicated bill. So although there's only two or three lines involved, or two or three clauses, the weighty matter of the use of deadly force can't be taken very lightly. Mm-hmm. So I ask you to address me on this matter.
Could I ask you a question?
Certainly.
And having missed yesterday's session, but Ms. Schaefer did fill me in a little bit. Is our task here not simply to make sure that what is legislated or what is now proposed by way of amendment complies with Johannes Vers in A through I, the Kriegler dictate? And isn't that all that we are here to do? Isn't that simple? For example, I believe that you had some discussion about the question of whether the commission of a serious crime at that point or later was not difficult, but Judge Krieger says, he speaks quite simply of ordinarily shooting not being permitted unless the suspect poses a threat of violence to the arrestor and is suspected on reasonable grounds of having committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction. And there are no other reasonable means of carrying out the arrest, whether at that time or later. Now, I mean, there it is. So although we might find it difficult in the proposed amendment, there it is. Ipsis in our verba. So, you know, some things are not, I think, the problem that perhaps they are being presented as being. To me, it's an interesting question whether the thing as it stands is not in order. The existing 1998 amendment, I'm not sure that it isn't in order. And that, Chair, might be a narrower approach to take to it than that set out by yourself, but it seems to me that is what we are here to do. I do agree with the difficult part, but to me that's the task.
That particular case that Krieger was... That's the Walters case. Okay, fair enough.
So in ordinary language, what applies, and although you can't put it in the way it stands here, surely is it general? I mean, that's what has to be conveyed to the police, and surely you give the police instructions. I mean, what's in the law is one thing, but what you put in the bookies and the leaflets for people implementing is something else. And just like New York's finest on the research of Christine Silkstone has a certain set of guidelines which make imminent sense to me. Surely you put for your men and women in an easily digestible form also exactly what Judge Krieger said. And it's quite simple, in fact. Can one not put his instructions A through I in a sheet and translate them into X languages? And for our purposes, simply make it laws which gives true effect to that.
And having looked at the amendment before us,
and I do think there's a problem maybe with the proviso, in as much as it doesn't appear to still to contain the requirements of reasonableness and proportionality, but I mean perhaps you just use some word other than provided or something. So I think it needs maybe a bit of work, but I'm not in my own mind convinced that the old one isn't right.
Chief, thank you very much. May I respond to that?
Yes.
Chief, thank you. I just want to start off by, I think right at the outset when we first did the briefing, I explained to the committee that we're dealing with a sensitive issue because it's a very, very serious matter. We're not dealing with a difficult technical issue. In that context, it's a very simple matter. The department's view is that the law with regard to the use of force when arresting a person is laid down in Walters completely, and we do not even contemplate trying to change what Walters said. We cannot lessen that burden. It is the Constitutional Court that laid down the law. Our task was simply, and our approach has simply been to align what 49 presently reads with what the Constitutional Court said in Walters. So in that respect, I agree with Ms. Watts. And the test for this bill would simply be to see if there's a complete harmonization with what they said in Walters and what 49 now says. That's the first thing. The second thing, and this is a theme recurring throughout the comments that were made. I think it's common knowledge that some of the respondents started reacting to rumors when the bill was first mooted, and I've got blogs that were written, etc. And quite clearly there's a distinct school. A school saying that it's not clear that the proportionality requirement is applicable to the proviso, and there's another school that never can pick that up. Interestingly enough, the school that argues in that direction is from one person and his or her followers in terms of the respondents. That's very clear. I could see that very clear, and also from reading and studying what was written in the, let's say, cyberspace on the matter. No other legal academic even raised that issue. We've been clear from the start, and I've got absolutely no doubt in my mind, that you cannot read a proviso where you cannot interpret a proviso as something that's standing loose from the part that it qualifies. It is very simple, and I think in the presentation that I dealt with, and unfortunately I see that members now got a copy of the presentation, but I was very interested. You must have the speaker's note. That is the detailed info that we keep to our chest to give us some advantage to the audience. But you'll find that this is the authority in case law there. How do you interpret the proviso? But be that as it may, the worrying thing for me was that people who are highly regarded can interpret the provision in that manner. So we cannot overlook that. Even if I do not agree with him 100%, the fact remains that there is such an interpretation. Now, that's something we've got to live with and deal with. If you read Sleiman, for example, on 49, you'll see outrageous interpretations, in my mind, as to the existing 49. But that's one of the reasons why we're aligning the section, because we've got a legal academic that's highly regarded, that's in fact adored by and used by the police in their training, with one view on the matter. And even if we do not agree with him, we want to create that harmony, at least, so that some of the scope for the argument fall away. Heemstra, on the other hand, holds a different view. And if you read Heemstra, and again I'm referring to that presentation, that you see that Heemstra, who's really regarded, or the Heemstra book, I think it's updated later by Krichler, and I do not know who the latest editors were. He stated very clearly when he discusses 49 that the requirement of proportionality has always been there, even pre-94, and it is now clearly and specifically written into the law, and referring to section 49 as it stands. So anybody could even argue that the proviso, I'm not going to go there through it again, but in order to cover that, and there's something for the committee to chew over, I've this morning distributed a little document where I've just added or suggested a different wording. Now, I suppose the legal term would be ex abundante cautela. It's something that goes against the grain when you do legislative drafting. The last time I can remember an example like this was more than a decade ago when we dealt with floor crossing legislation. And the argument arose in the committee and between some of the submissions, what does the term a year mean? If you say that the next window will be 3 years, is a year, calendar year, etc. And we wrote in the law, and it appeared in the constitution, for the purposes of this section, a year means 365 days. Now this is a similar kind of amendment that I'm proposing. Well, that's why we say 306. Maybe Mr. Jeffrey was the one that raised the problem. See, but if you look at that little proposal, there's an option too. It's really just a... what I'm suggesting that it could possibly be considered is to put the proviso that the arrest apart, to remove that as well, and that your whole subsection 2 would then read as follows. If any arrestor attempts to arrest a suspect, and the suspect resists the attempt and flees, when it is clear that an attempt to arrest him is being made and the suspect cannot be arrested without the use of force, the arrestor may, in order to effect the arrest, use such force as may be reasonably necessary and proportional in the circumstances to overcome the resistance or to prevent the suspect from fleeing. But in addition to the requirement that the force must be reasonably necessary and proportional in the circumstances, the arrestor may use deadly force, etc., etc., etc. I think that makes it doesn't really, in my mind, change anything, but it makes it absolutely clear. There can be no argument to the contrary. Then another thing that I want to very briefly share, and please stop me if I'm abusing the fact that I've got the floor or the mic, draw attention to is, as I said, we really followed the wording of the Constitutional Court, but we in fact added one requirement. If you look at A, it says the suspect poses a threat of serious violence to the arrestor or any other person. Judge Krichler in Walters didn't use the word serious. We inserted that. So it's a bit more of a burden. Serious violence. Then there was an argument yesterday, some issues were raised about the use of the words grievous or serious. The previous or existing provision refers to grievous. We followed the word serious just because Krichler used it in Walters. No other reason. We've done, I've looked at Oxford, we've done it at Taurus, we really think that in law, it really, there's nothing turning on it. But in order to have the wording exactly as we've got it in the Walters judgment, we use it serious, and that's simply all there is to the check. I beg your pardon, sir. You didn't use that, Chair. We really followed... I know that some of the commentators made quite a big deal of the fact that the immediate is taken out, but we really followed the wording used by Chrysler and Walters. It was never used. Our view, in any event, with regard to the existing one, which says that the force is immediately necessary for the purposes of protecting. Now, Chair, this has been a bugbear right from the start when the wording was first formulated in 1998. I don't know if any members are still survivors of that old committee, but those who were will remember that it took more than a year to deal with the wording at the time. And this was a compromise wording. We were not happy. If you read the existing provision, let me just turn to that very briefly, because it's been an issue that's been raised yesterday time and again, and whether the existing provision isn't in fact fine. And there, more from a technical perspective than otherwise, it is not fine. It says, and I'm really referring to the existing provision, and you will find that in that part that's involved in the bill, provided that the arrestor is justified in terms of this section in using deadly force that is intended or likely to cause death. Now, already you've got a problem. Deadly force that's intended or likely to cause death. Can you then use deadly force that's not intended? Is it still deadly force? Immediately those kind of questions start arising. And then, as was pointed out by various commentators, and which we've in fact seen from our first round of informal consultation in the Gazette, and we've amended the bill, and I think the concept is now very clear. The existing provision still has the concept that you can deliberately kill in order to effect an arrest, which is nonsensical. You cannot arrest a dead person. So that is part of the problem of the existing provision. And then, as some of the commentators pointed out, the language is confusing, and also in the presentation that I dealt with, I can think of at least four articles that were written by legal academics at the time before the commencement, and must remember this thing was passed in 98, but it only commenced in 2003. After Walters, they wrote articles and said, never put that other thing in operation because it's going to be confusing. We've got the law now. The law is clear in Walters. Do not bother to put this into operation. So that is just an indication. As I said, not a lot turns about it. Because the law is clear, the law is laid down in Walters. But 49 as it is now is not aligned with Walters, and that is really all we're trying to achieve.
Advocate Holomisa, sir?
A small matter, Chairperson, regarding the question of the use of the word serious as opposed to grievous. It's just been explained that it's because Judge Crickler chose the word serious instead of grievous. Is there any indication as to whether or not the judge did apply his mind to the question of which of these two words is appropriate, seeing that we are required to follow his terminology in reasoning?
I think we will always accept that the Constitutional Court judge applied his mind when giving judgment. And what makes it particularly difficult in this case, or interesting, he started off, in the objects memo we've repeated those points A to I, but it started off, he says, in order to make perfectly clear what the position is. So that is perfectly clear. There's little room for argument there.
But how do we know then as to why it is that he didn't use the word egregious? Is it not a question maybe of assuming that they mean the same thing or something else?
I think, sir, that the only reasonable assumption is that he assumed it means exactly the same thing. And we cannot really find it. Like I said, I've looked at what the dictionary, you look at grievous in the dictionary and it explains it says serious. You look at serious, you also find a reference to grievous. So I really think nothing turns on it in the end. I do not think there's degrees of comparison in terms of law and in terms of injuries of serious.
The crime, sir, that is called grievous bodily harm.
Yes, sir.
And it's not referred to as serious bodily harm. Would you care to comment on that?
Chair, that is, I think, simply because of the inherent quality of the law and the legal professions do transform. we're moving to plain language now. That's why we're not saying in this committee, for example, be it enacted by Parliament. We say Parliament enacts as follows. I think it's really the same thing. And two, I can assure you that legally nothing turns on this.
Mr. Chief, there's a thing of I wasn't sure whether Judge Quickler had used, I thought it was the earlier thing where you've qualified the threat of violence to be serious threat of violence. I thought that was the issue, but I see then later he does refer to serious bodily harm as opposed to grievous. But I would have thought that people don't really use grievous in normal terminology anymore. They use the word serious. So why must we be? I know some things are traditional, but why must we be married to grievous when it actually means serious? But Chair, look, I wasn't here, like Ms. Smuts, I wasn't here, well, I for most of the presentation, but to me the issue is we're writing the law not for the police but for the lawyers. I think that is clear. The police do not read the Criminal Procedure Act. They're going to have it explained to them in manuals. So I think that would be my first suggestion, is we're not making something that is necessarily clear to a layperson. We're making it clear to the lawyers that there can be no disputes. And so it is worrying if earlier drafts had Sneyman or whatever saying one thing and Heemstra saying another. And it really just seems to hang on how much does this section does this section properly capture what is in the Quickler judgment? And that's really then surely the sole question that we've got. Maybe a question linked to that is, since the Quickler judgment, look, lots of people have died, have been killed by the police. But I don't know what cases there have been, and has there been any legal uncertainty with Quickler, with the Quickler judgment, since it came out. Legal disputes in court between, so one's not talking about, one can think of some of the more topical cases in the news, although those haven't been to court, but one would have thought with those cases, regardless of the wording, if what one sees in the media is correct, then there's no clue how a police officer could have tried, fit or unfit, smoker or non-smoker, could have tried to have used the existing provision or any provision. But, Jerry, this is basically a question. Has anyone expressed any legal uncertainty over the Quickler provisions?
Jerry, to my knowledge, no. The last time I researched this matter, there were no reported judgment as at the time. That was about September last year. I will check it again, and I'd appreciate if the researchers could also look at that. I'll also inquire from the NPA and maybe from the Police Legal Services if there are any pending cases, but the only case regarding the application of 49 since the Quickler judgment that I could find that was reported came to the conclusion that 49 wasn't even applicable. The person had no right to stop. It was somebody running away and an officer holding out his arm and injuring the person in the process. The person didn't even know that he was back there in an attempt to arrest him, so the court just said 49 is not applicable. But up to date, I don't know of any such cases.
Yeah, then I think it's a question of, does this match what is in the Quickler judgment? We may want to, I mean, I see Mr. Langer's sort of wording, I don't know what the police's view on that is. We may want to circulate that to some of the textbook, criminal law textbook writers, because, as I said, what we want is legal certainty. I'm not convinced that, I see what Mr. De Lange is trying to do, but I'm not convinced that, if we are following, if the principle is we're following the Quickler principles, why we want to put in serious violence, because that's another objective factor. I know it limits the police, but does it not create uncertainty? What is serious violence? What is serious violence for police officer on the spot, you know, not the armchair. Mm. And so I'm not 100% convinced that putting serious in under violence is a good thing. But I mean, I'd want to think about that some more. But Chair, that would just be a suggestion of should we not be then talking about does option two, which I think is a bit clearer, what do the police think of it? Does that reflect what is in the Krikler principles? And do we want to look at sending it to, I mean, are the Sneymans and Hiemsters still alive, or are they?
Academic's still alive where I can approach. I'm not Hiemster, I don't think he's involved. I think he's still alive, but he's not involved. Sneyman, I'm not too sure if he'll be interested, but he's also still alive, too.
Well, without wanting to bring religion into this little discussion about serious and grievous, I'm Catholic, almost lapsed. But very early, when I was about 5 or 6, we were taught there are two types of sins, grievous sin and a mortal sin. What's a grievous sin? Well, if you steal your friend's sweet, that's a grievous sin. Okay, and mortal? Murder, right? So maybe we should call it mortal bodily harm or mortal deadly force.
What about immortalizing bodily harm?
Okay. Because I also heard the use of the word grievous, and I realized where Advocate Holomisa was going to. And I said, well, is there a difference? It would seem that from a legal perspective there is. Jim.
Thank you, Jerry. If I may just bring a little bit possible clarity on this. You know, we have the crime assault with the intention to cause grievous bodily harm. And that is the exact crime that you have been referring to. Now, that terminology, grievous bodily harm, came to us from English law. Mm-hmm. So it was actually imported from English law. It was never domestic in South Africa.
But whenever you use the word traditional advocate, you need to just distinguish for us.
The question I'm asking here is that which aspect of our law has ever been domestic? Because the other one is Romantic, as I understand, and the other one is English.
Chair, I used the wrong term. I should have said indigenous and not domestic.
Mr. DeLange?
Chair, I've done my best so far to make my views at least as clear as possible to the committee and to give them as much as possible ease of mind. But if I could turn the tables, there's one thing in the Krikler judgment that could be very, very, let's say, interesting. Paragraph H, which starts with saying, ordinarily such shooting is not permitted. I always wondered ordinarily. what is extraordinary then, the position? But that is something I'm just raising to amuse members, Chair.
Such shooting. Yes, but such shooting. Okay. The scenario of the policeman coming face to face with a bank robber as he exits the bank carrying an AK-47 is something that we need to bear in mind. And the fact this was raised yesterday, that quite often the member of the police service is required to make a snap judgment. Coming to him later and saying, you see, here we have section 49, you didn't follow it, may not always help.
and do remember that the purpose of arrest is not to punish. The purpose is to bring the guy to court. And maybe there must be circumstances where you let the guy go because you are going to arrest him later.
And if he starts shooting at you? Okay. All right. Mr. Jeffrey?
With the AK-47 is, to me, quite clearly within the, you can shoot him within the bounds of the amendment, and it is basically the suspect is suspected on reasonable grounds of having committed a crime involving the threatened infliction of serious bodily harm. Somebody who you think has robbed a bank and is carrying an AK-47 has used that AK-47 to threaten. I think it's clear. I think the issue basically is, does one go in the bill for a belts and braces list and to say armed robbery, you know, a suspect of armed robbery, can deadly force can be used if they're fleeing and resisting arrest. Because it's clearly, armed robbery has to be a threatened infliction of serious bodily harm. Does one go for that list? And then the problem is you maybe leave out things or you don't think of them. Or does one leave it as it is, as broad, which is what Krichler gave us, and then the police in their training would presumably do a manual which says, these are the cases, these are the kinds of crimes, these are the circumstances that you may use deadly force. But to my mind, I don't know how it came up. To my mind, a robber exiting a bank armed with an AK-47 or any other serious weapon and is resisting arrest, deadly force can be used in terms of what is here. Because it's the threatened infliction, a crime involving the threatened infliction, not the infliction of the threatened. So you don't have to check whether they shot anyone in the bank.
No.
It's a question of they threatened. But I think, as I said, I think the issue is basically, do we go for, I see the police shaking their heads, in not wanting it. Do we go for a list, or do we leave it sort of as it is, and they come up with a list in their training, and they seem to prefer that they come up with a list, which obviously then can easily be amended as circumstances develop.
I certainly don't think we should go for a list. Chairman, would you allow me to ask the General two other things that are directly relevant, although they are now off the point? Let me start and stop me if you don't want me. I have a letter from a journalist who is also a reservist and is very concerned about this whole law. The letter itself is already 2 years old.
A journalist who is a reservist?
Yes, a police reservist.
Contradiction.
He does it anonymously, but I'll tell you later who it is. For his own reasons, he wishes to be anonymous. And he says the following things. That there are other provisions that are omitted in the breach, and it would help the police if they were enforced. He says, firstly, provisions such as complying with a police official's instructions, resisting arrest, interfering with a police official when he or she is carrying out a duty, assaulting a police official, and failure to answer a police official's questions, should be vigorously enforced and properly prosecuted. In our discussions, he and other reservists, we could not remember the last time any of these provisions were actually prosecuted. For instance, if a suspect is arrested on a charge of car theft and then resists the arrest, and that is also laid in the docket, the latter charge is null prosecuted, he says, in other words, dropped altogether. What is the point of having such charges on the statute books if the prosecutors do not pursue them? Because of this situation, the feeling is that the public really believe that it is quite all right disrupt a police action or lawful arrest, as there is no sanction that is enforced. This then places innocent members of the public and the police in potentially extra danger, as then, as often is the case, the officials have to resort to force, which often means deadly force and the consequences thereof. And Britain, Hong Kong, US, Canada, the seemingly simple charge of failing to obey a policeman's instructions is often the primary charge, and the secondary one is then theft and so on. Then he raises another thing which I just find quite intriguing. He says, in our circumstances, it's a little extraneous. He says, Firearms Control Act and relevant sections of the CPA about pointing a firearm should be dropped. The reasoning is that there are many instances of potentially such a serious nature that there's good reason for a police official to draw and point his or her firearm. These include instances of stopping and searching vehicles late at night. I've had 4 colleagues killed in such situations over the years. Searching premises that are located in known dangerous locations, searching for known and suspected armed suspects in fields or buildings. Often suspects lay countercharges against policemen for, and one favorite is that of pointing a firearm. As any defense lawyer will tell you, the police are not exempt from this charge. However, the reasoning for pointing a firearm is this. It allows the police official to adopt a ready stance in times of potential danger without breaking a law. It reinforces the message to a potentially dangerous suspect that to resist arrest is pointless and that the matter is of an extremely serious nature. The risk of a negligent discharge is always a risk and can be prosecuted, and so forth. And I realize that is in contradiction, for example, with the New York NYPD, the New York's finest. But it's stayed with me ever since he wrote this, and I would be, if you're happy, interested in the general's views.
Thank you, Jay. It's very interesting. We considered that position when we drafted the South African Police Service Act that was adopted in 1994. Now, Section 67 of that act specifically makes provision that any person who resists or willfully hinders or obstructs a member of the service in the performance of his functions will be guilty of an offence. So, there is already an offence of this nature. Yes, it is prosecuted, however, one must be very careful because people abuse that situation. You know, you don't want to have a situation where a police official, every time he arrests somebody or gets somebody charged, now also brings in this charge to say that my instructions were not followed. That's not exactly what was the intention. The intention was a situation where somebody prevents the police from performing their functions. So if that person go so far as to prevent the police from doing their work, then he will be guilty of this offense. That's the first remark I need to make. The second remark, and I think it's very, very important, the remark made by the person concerning the pointing of a firearm. You know what, ma'am? The chairperson. Okay, the pointing of a firearm, yes, it is an offence in terms of the Firearms Control Act. And there is no question that we want it to remain an offence. There is no question about that. And it's irrespective of whether the pointing takes place by a police official or by an ordinary member of the public. However, obviously a police official will be justified in certain circumstances to point the firearm. Now let me just explain the training that we present to members. You know, I don't want to get into theatrics, but I think it's important that you understand, if you look at my hand now and you regard this as the barrel of the gun, then our police members are trained that when they are in a situation that may get serious, they are supposed to stand like this. You understand? Now, that would not be a pointing of a firearm. But the moment when the situation gets out of hand, you can lift up and pull the trigger. So you understand, that's to protect our members. So they must always have the firearm in this position. We call this position the ready position. In other words, it's very easy to change that direction of the barrel of the gun to point to somebody. That's the way. So as far as we are concerned, there's no need to change the law. They can do so. They are trained to do so.
We have requested of General Halanes and the police that they provide us with, one, their existing policies on the use of force, deadly force, two, their national instructions on the use of force, and three, their standing orders. Yeah, so that that will further assist us, you know.
Is that we ask our counterparts on the police committee to deal with that, in terms of our workload and strictly speaking. I mean, I think it's very important, and people are being killed wrongly, and it's bad. But I think that police should be following up the training issues and things.
All right, fair enough. It's just that we thought that we'd get a better understanding of how they draw up their manuals and training manuals, etc., by obtaining this. So the request still stands. And then there was a suggestion by someone that we should also ask for François Biokman to come and speak to us.
Thank you, Chief. Let me make two remarks. Number one, we have the documents as requested by yourself. Okay. Available here, and I will provide it to Mr. Romano. He can actually make copies of it and provide it to him.
Fair enough.
However, the one part which is difficult for us to deal with is the request that we must provide copies of our standing orders. Now, sir, I can promise you, because I did so myself, if you put them printed on one page of A4 page and you put them face down on a table and you measure the height, it will be 600 millimeters.
Okay.
You understand?
Yes.
Because it deals with every conceivable aspect of policing. So what I did was to select the standing orders that I believe may be of relevance to the committee. And that's the first point. Secondly, and this is very important, we are now engaged in the process to review all our standing orders. And in actual fact, it's my responsibility. So I have people working on it, the environments, coming to me, and I check the legality of the standing orders. So some of the standing orders that I would have preferred to give you are now outdated and in the process of being reviewed. So I don't think it will be fair to provide those to you.
Okay. Well, I think now we're beginning to understand why you smoke as heavily as you do. Mr. Jeffrey.
It's just, I mean, my worry is the amount of work we've got as this committee, and the amount we've already got, I think, 7 pieces of legislation. I was just looking in a different capacity at the department's legislative program, and it's not nice. It's horrible. Mr. Lung is smiling because he knows. I mean, it's going to be I think released to Parliament in the next few days. I mean, if it hasn't, I mean, that would be the whole of government's program, but it's just a question of are we going to do justice? This is a very important issue. I'm not undermining the seriousness of the issue, but is it good use of our, and it is a huge problem. I mean, people are being killed. You should not be killed. Whether it is looking at, and obviously there's got to be court cases, this boy, 16-year-old, I think it was in Soweto in the past week, the Andres Tatane case, you know, those were all affecting arrest cases. I'm not talking about the self-defense cases. And then there's the other side of the story of the police officials being killed and things. But is it actually good use of our time to go into that. Shouldn't we be saying to the police portfolio committee, we think you should be looking at? Then with the decision, look, I don't want to sort of do Dr. Ambrosini, and that is, you know, not be in a meeting and then try and reverse the decision, but I would have urged that, you know, because the ICD, I mean, there's a whole lot of issues with you know, the ICD and the police injuring or killing people. To me, my mind, it's a question of, do the ICD have anything to say on this proposed amendment? And that's it. And I would have thought it could even be in writing. Would you like, you know, so it's the thing, if this is the proposed amendment, what do you think about it? If you've got something to say, come and say it to us. If you're happy with it, then just tell us you're happy and you don't need to come. And then we finalise this so that we can move on. But I really would urge that a lot of, even the stuff in Ms. Smuts's letter, because it's wider things. I mean, they're interesting things and they're important things. But that we shouldn't be getting into it as this committee because of time.
When there is another committee of parliament that
sure. Sure. Take your point, Dean Smuts.
May I propose a compromise? Since neither of us was here yesterday, and I don't think we can now reverse. I would value Francois's input. I think it's a good idea to ask him to give it in writing, both as a lawyer and with his background. Ask him if he wishes to do it in writing, if he wishes to appear, however, of course he must, because I support what my colleague Debbie Schaefer, her work yesterday. In the case of the General's paperwork, thank you for those that he has brought. Chair, could we not accept those and skip the standing orders, all 600 millimetres of them, and leave those to our colleagues in the Police Committee? And then basically we're there, because then we hear what Francois has to say in writing, go and apply our minds to Mr. De Longa's new draft, and then do the deed. All we have to do is give effect to Johannes Jungfers or dot e. Oh yeah.
All right, well, Lizelle.
Chairperson, I might be wrong. I just want to know the paragraph A, the suspect poses a threat of serious violence to the arrest or any other person. Doesn't that border on private defense? And isn't the whole purpose of Section 49 to make sure that the arrestor doesn't flee and are actually brought to justice? Because I know the previous presenter also mentioned that that part was an extra part that was added onto it.
Yes, I agree. It does border on private defense. But again, that is exactly what Judge Kessler said. Now, I thought about it, in fact, this morning. I think it's correct to say it borders on private defense. It's not necessarily, but there is an area of overlap possibly there. But it would be very difficult to leave it out, seeing as it's put down so clearly in Walter.
We share on one level. I would have thought
this should go out of the CPA and into the Police Act and the you know, but there's lots of provisions. I mean, as in this one presentation, there's lots of provisions dealing with, in the CPA, dealing with arrest, so I'm not going to go there. But part of the problem is that use of force in effecting arrest has been separated from other use of force, which is presumably in the Police Act. And that maybe confuses not the police, who are probably not reading with respect, not reading either acts, but confusing the sort of middle layer of people who are reading the one and not the other and then getting themselves confused. But we're not reinventing the wheel. Section 49 is in the CPA, it stays there.
I mean, there's other stuff in the CPA which is so old-fashioned in its expression, we should really be looking at modernizing. But I mean, let's not go there. But the one about the affray. What is an affray? It always, and the gentleman in a
British thing.
I know, within a cravat in hot pursuit. I mean, how is that, you know, how must anybody in modern South Africa understand what it is? But we won't go there since we have too much work.
In Afrikaans, it's called Pomerons. Affray.
Actually,
General.
Dear, thank you. I think it's important that in the context of what Mr. Jeffrey said, that the committee must take note of the fact that the South African Police Service Act in Section 13 already provides that a police official may use force in the performance of his functions insofar as he is specifically authorized by an Act of Parliament to do so. And if he exercises that force or uses that force, he must at all times use the minimum force which is needed in order to achieve the function. So you have to read that in any event together with Section 49. Yes, Section
1330. Yes. Can you put your mic on, Mr. Jeffrey?
No, it was just that in Australia that only constables can kill people. I mean, the whole wording was the constable believes on reasonable grounds that doing that thing is necessary to protect life or prevent serious injury to another person, in brackets, including the constable. But I mean, it just seems if you're a sergeant, I don't know what the next level they have. Without limiting the operation of subsection 1, a constable... I see it broader as it's a member of... It's all the police then. You did it, Gillian. It's all the police. But it just, without looking at that footnote, I would have then thought, okay, sergeants are not allowed to use force. So if there's a guy fleeing and you've got to then get the sergeant has to get the constable to do the deed. But I see that their word constable is more broadly defined.
General?
I didn't know, Chairperson. I am a general in the police service.
Yes.
And last year, I made my last arrest.
Oh.
Personally, without the assistance of any other member. Because I went into a shopping center, and there was this guy running, and people shouting. And I then eventually arrested the guy.
With your gun? With your revolver?
I grabbed him.
Oh, good.
No force was used.
Oh, that's force.
No, I mean,
no firearms. The only problem I experienced afterwards was that my cell phone fell out of my pocket.
Shame.
So that was a serious problem.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the shopping center could have bought a new one for you.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. All right. Well,
I'm aware of that, and as I said, it's two or three clauses.
Well, look, it was just the idea when Mr. Delano raised that some of the textures of the original existing provisions are wrong, which, that maybe when you've got the opportunity, may be useful asking because they may be wrong. And the images, I think Mr. Delano himself said that there's a kind of perception. To form that view is problematic, shows that the problem is already something to do with. So, I think it's So I don't know, it was just a, as I said, it was just a float. We're not proceeding immediately. But I do think we should be setting timelines.
Yep.
Like, you know, we're giving the ICD, we're going to be around long enough time during the ICD to apply.
Are we giving them 2 weeks?
No, I'm just sort of saying, to my mind, 2 weeks is a reasonable time.
Well, that is reasonable. Yes, unless he specifically asks. Yeah.
At this point, we're not looking at use of force generally. We're looking at the wording of this section.
Yes.
The other matters around the training, can he go and raise that with the committee?
Sure. But I think it arose in the context, Mr. Jeffrey, yesterday, of whether the ICD or the new... I forget their name.
Okay.
IPED. We live in an age of acronyms. Are adequately resourced and capacitated.
But that is not our... No.
It's not. We accept that. But however you look at it, these things do impact on the on the issue at hand. And so, General Haldanes yesterday. Had to respond to all these matters. And as a consequence, the idea that perhaps Frans von Beekman should be asked to also respond came about. General?
Thank you, Chair. But I think for the benefit of Mr. Jeffrey, I yesterday explained that the IPED Act is not yet in operation. But it is likely to come into operation in the very near future.
Mm.
Now, in anticipation of that, we are already in discussions with the ICD in order to enter into a memorandum of agreement to ensure that we and the ICD will be working together to solve the problems. And one of the issues which I think that many of the commentators or the persons who made submissions made was that there must be proper control over the police use of force, okay? And that certain forms, in certain instances, this must be reported to IPED in terms of the new act. So we are entering into an agreement with them to ensure that the forms, the information they will require in order to conduct a proper independent investigation will be available to them, and we are on the brink of getting to a point where we have agreement on what will be the cooperation between the police and IPED in this regard. So that is in place. We are busy with that. Obviously, if you talk about the legislation and Section 49 more specifically, IPED may, or ICD, whatever you want to call them, may want to make comments or give inputs. But please understand that the ICB will come to an end very soon.
General Haldanes, I mean, I would have thought a... I mean, the issue for us is Section 49,
mm-hmm.
comments on Section 49. I would have thought that a provision requiring any use of force under Section 49.2 to be reported to IPED to be a useful statutory provision, but if such a provision were to be made, it belongs in the IPED Act, not in the CPA, and so that's also where, which is, and the IPED Act is not our jurisdiction. So if, for example, ICD want to come and say that very point, I think they're coming to the wrong place.
Sure.
We could amend the IPED Act, but it's not our act.
No.
I mean, we can physically do it, but so I just that's why I think we need to be careful around things that should be taken to the police. And then my worry is every I don't know whether you'd call them state government, state official, I mean they're independent, but every person receiving state funding I'm sure feels they're not getting enough money, and I'm sure Mr. Beekman may like the opportunity to say he's not getting enough money, but again, it's not. There's nothing we can do about it. He must go and tell the police committee. Resourcing, you know, under-resourced and any opportunity type of thing. Yeah. Anyway, I'm maybe being unfair to him, but I.
Advocate Holomir, sir.
Thank you, sir. I understand that Rachel is concerned, and maybe what you might want to do is to ask the ICD or IPD to indicate its use on the formulation of the amendment it wants to effect. Because in my understanding, the reason why we wanted them to address us is because each time a policeman kills a person, the complaint is referred to that body. So therefore, they might be helpful in assisting us in coming up with the right formulation of this amendment, so that these incidents that are referred to them all the time are not occur so frequently.
All right.
So maybe they can just be requested to comment on the formulation that is here and make suggestions as to which one. Good.
Good. I think we'll ask them to look at the original amendment bill and then the document Mr. De Lange gave us this morning. Well, I think we'll argue they're dealing with so many cases that they felt that was more important. All right. Well, honourable members, it seems like we're done for today. I do agree with Mr. Jeffrey when he reminds us that this is a 2010 bill, that we don't have unlimited time, and there are further pieces of legislation on the horizon, and there's really no need for us to delay unnecessarily with this one. So, with that in mind, I thank you for your inputs this morning. General Caldenes, Colonel von Rooyen, once more, thanks to you. Mr. De Lange, our thanks to you as well. And we'll see some of you tomorrow. Otherwise, the committee will meet next week, Tuesday. And we're adjourned.